Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello and welcome to the Motormouth podcast with Harry Benjamin and Tim Sylvie. This is the place where we meet some of the biggest names in and around motorsport, chat about their lives and everything in between.
We've partnered with the Brain Tumor Charity, helping to raise awareness and help find a cure. Thanks to our partnership, we've been able to create a short series of special podcasts uncovering those within the motorsport community who've been affected by these devastating diagnoses. You can hear these stories, including the Williams F1 team's planning director, Richard Jones, right now on your chosen podcast player. The charity work all year round to help develop research and raise awareness. And this October sees the return of the Brain Tumor Charity's most beloved community event, the Twilight Walk. You can join them remotely this autumn to cover 10 kilometres, 40 kilometres, 130 kilometres, or your very own distance to raise money and take strides towards a cure. Moving about is well known for boosting our well-being, and you can complete your walk bit by bit or all in one go as a team or by yourself at home or indoors. So visit www.thetwilightwalk.com to sign up and start your fundraising challenge. A huge thank you for your support. If you can donate anything, you can do that through the motormouth.club website or through the Brain Tumor Charity direct, and together we can help every single person affected by a brain tumor. It's season 9 and we're really excited to be once again teaming up with F1 Experiences, the official experience, hospitality and travel program of Formula 1. F1 Experiences is the closest you can get to the pinnacle of motorsport. And let's face it, any chance to get close to Formula 1 this year, we're all over it. And the brilliant news is you can now be trackside thanks to F1 Experiences. Enjoy the very best race tickets and track hospitality, first class hotels and unprecedented access you simply cannot get anywhere else. For more information on how you can book your F1 experience, visit f1experiences.com, where you can also save 5% on your very own F1 experiences package by using the code MOTORMOUTH when checking out online. So, what are you waiting for? Experience the 2021 F1 season firsthand with exclusive access courtesy of F1 Experiences. Get booking today at f1experiences.com.
Hello everyone, Tim Sylvie here. Now, today's guest hails from Shropshire but was raised in Wolverhampton. And did you know that the city, and yes it is a city, and was named so on the 18th of December in the year 2000, making it one of three millennium cities, the others being Brighton and Inverness, is home to one of the most successful football clubs in the country, if you go back to the 1950s. During that era, they won three Football League championships, which was then the highest division, two FA Cups, and were involved in the earliest European friendly matches. They were hailed by the press as the unofficial world champions after one of their most famous wins against Honved of Hungary, and they were the first English team to ever play in the Soviet Union. The city's almost also famous for producing the band Slade. But Harry Benjamin, can you tell me how many number ones Slade had? Was it A, 2, B, 4, C, 8, or D, 6?
I feel like I only know one Slade song. Maybe that's, oh God. So I'm going to say two, but I feel like that's horrifically wrong.
You're going for A, two. You're saying Slade had two number ones.
Yes.
Wrong.
Oh,
so Slade had six number ones in the 70s, which were Cause I Love You, Take Me Back Home, Mama, We're All Crazy, spelt in a very funny way, Come On, Feel the Noise, Squeeze Me, Please Me, Come On, you must know that one, and Merry Christmas, Everybody, of course.
Yeah, I knew that one.
Yeah. Yeah. So another totally poor effort from you on the quiz front.
70s music is not my strong suit, I have to admit. I'm sorry. Well, I could only apologise.
You weren't born by about 20 years, so I think you're forgiven.
Top 40 in the charts. You can ask me that and I'll get it right straight away.
Oh, well, that's not the question. Right, shall I introduce today's guest?
Yeah, let's get on with it.
So today we're joined by Susie Perry, hailing from aforementioned Wolverhampton, but born at RAF Cosworth in Shropshire. She's a proper Wolves footy fan, but I won't bore you with the history of Molyneux. After completing her education, I do know the history of Molyneux, by the way. After completing her education, she went on to work for Sky Sports and, of course, was a fixture on our Formula One screens with the BBC. She's arguably best known for her MotoGP work, but she's done a whole load more, including Goodwood Festival of Speed, where she did that interview with Valentino Rossi. She's also fronted National Lottery coverage, City Hospital, Watchdog, The Gadget Show, Treasure Hunt, Superstars, BBC News, BBC Radio 2, BBC Sport, BT Sport, to name it just a few. We're here to find out about her life, opinions, views, fears and more. Susie Perry, welcome to the Motormouth podcast.
Thank you. And obviously, I've been around forever with that list.
It's an impressive list.
Did you know how many number one Slade had?
Well, I would have gone for six. Yes, aww. I would have gone for six. Actually, I might have gone for the higher number because I thought, has Merry Christmas Everyone been number one about 10 times over the decades? I'm not quite sure. But I know the boys, actually. I know the Slade boys. Awesome. They're all fantastic, honestly. They're all just so lovely.
Do you, I know you're a Wolves fan. Do you know the history of Molyneux?
I think reasonably well. I've been there enough, but I posted a picture of myself on Instagram yesterday, lying in the changing room across the bench, and then Instagram went offline, so lots of people had me on their Instagram feed all day lying in the Wolves changing room, which is fine if you're a Wolves fan.
Yeah,
but there's some banter going on yesterday. Anyway, I am a massive Wolves fan, and actually you said I came from RAF Cosworth because you're such a motormouth and it's Cosford. That made me laugh because it shows you've got cars on your brain.
Damn it. There's always something. We always get something wrong. But we had the right cities. You're a Wolves fan, we know that. Wikipedia did its thing.
It's a good slip, that one, isn't it?
It is a good
Cosworth.
Slip.
We'll have that one. We don't mind that one.
It's not the worst mistake Tim's made ever in introducing guests. He can't just get their complete nationality.
Do you know what the worst one was?
Wrong.
The most embarrassing one was when we had Freddie Hunt on, James Hunt's son, and I called him James. That was a bit of a clanger.
All that stuff's easily said. I think I was once in Spa and said we were in a completely different country, and to which Eddie Jordan just fell on the floor laughing, and he was going, you're human. I'm like, that's not very helpful now, Eddie, thanks.
Just the
I'm sure we've had Eddie on the show before, and he is certainly a character. I'm sure we'll come across him and his exploits at some point as well. But let's dive into all about your career, Susie, if I may, and take it right back to the start, actually, and how it all began. You know, take us up to those days growing up. Was all broadcasting and sport always on the brain, or how did it come about?
A lot of sport. I was a sport billy at school, and in all the teams. I was lucky enough to go to a school where we did everything, absolutely everything. I would go in the morning, do sport, lunchtime sport, after school, weekends. My dad had his own football team. I was completely enveloped in the sporting world. And whilst I wasn't brilliant at any one particular sport, I did partake in many. And I kind of grew up in a very active way. Not so much broadcasting. I watched sport on TV, but music really was my first love. My dad was an agent and a promoter. So I grew up going to see a lot of live bands and being around live music. My godfather was in Whitesnake, and
Oh, cool.
Have an eclectic mix of music taste depending on what mood I'm in. So I really just had a kind of a lovely childhood growing up with lots of loves, lots of passions, lots of energy, lots of support, which has been important in later life. And motorsport, yeah, we loved it in this house. We watched it, you know, when I was growing up, grandstand was always on, and I really enjoyed it. But it wasn't really probably until my early 20s that I started to ride bikes, and I had a boyfriend who was a biker, and all his friends, and we used to go out, and we used to go to the British Superbikes and World Superbike, and, you know, got completely obsessed with watching it and became one of those noisy sofa fans that shouts at the telly, why don't they do this and why don't they do that? And so, you know, the guys at the time, my friends at the time said, why don't you ring them and ask them? So to cut a long story short, really, I did. I rang Sky Sports. I rang the reception and asked to speak to Martin Turner, who was producing the MotoGP, yeah, the MotoGP coverage at the time. Hadn't turned into MotoGP then. And I got put through to his phone, and it had his mobile phone number on the message. So I rang his mobile number and he picked up, and I started chatting with him. And he said, who are you? And I went, well, I'm nobody, I'm just a bike fan. He went, would you like to come in and have a cup of coffee with me?
Wow.
And I know. So I did. And I walked out with a job as a reporter and became the first girl to be a reporter in bike sport across the world, actually. There weren't any others back in 1997. So that's really where it all started.
It's amazing.
It was quite mad.
It's funny. We've had a few people from different broadcasting networks and so on, and Sky and Channel 4 and others, and a lot of them share a similar kind of story where they've stuck their neck out and received a life-changing moment. And it seems it's a good lesson, really, because I think a lot of people sort of sit back and wait for the opportunities to arrive, but sometimes you've just got to stick your neck out and go for it. It seems like you did that, and you received that life-changing moment where the guy's like, come and see me. Did you immediately, once you'd had that conversation with him, think, oh, no, this is, I'm a reporter now, this is where I see my future, and it was all mapped out for you? Or did it sort of creep up in a different way?
I'm not very good at planning or looking forward. It's not one of my best attributes at all. But I remember walking out of that chat with Martin, who I was really very lucky to meet, just being so full of joy, and I'll never forget that feeling. I thought it was going to burst. I was trying to play it cool in the room when he offered me the job, and then I walked out and I just wanted to hug somebody, but I was on my own. So I called my parents, and I couldn't believe that he'd offered me a job. You know, I kind of went in to see what the school was and maybe see if they would put me on some sort of course or give me some advice, or, you know, I wasn't really sure. So to walk out with a job really was incredibly fortunate, but I didn't know it was going to map out anything. I was so overjoyed and wanting to tell everybody that I didn't really think about the future. And it was tricky, you know, the first year was very difficult. As much as I really embraced it and loved it, it was a baptism of fire. So my first live broadcast was at Brands Hatch, 6 hours, and with open talkback, bikes, foreign riders that couldn't hit, you know, quite speak very well. It was a really weird scenario to be in when you haven't done any television before, you know, and people think that it's easy, and it's really not easy. I mean, obviously, I was a cub reporter, so I wasn't holding anything together. I was just doing interviews, but yeah, it was tough, and sometimes your words wouldn't come out properly, or you couldn't hear things, and it was a really good way to learn television. I remember watching back and thinking, oh my God, I'm bloody awful. What am I doing? There's people are watching this. And Martin and Rory Hopkins at Sky really helped me for those first few races. And then they gave me my own show in 1998, which was a highlight show. And then I was anchoring something. So, you know, it was a fast learning curve, but I relished it, and it set me on a good path. for sure.
All,
yeah.
All thanks to that lady in reception who put you through. And
yeah, actually, it was kind of thanks to a man called Maurice Jones, who used to work with my dad. And he was a music promoter. And he was one of the promoters that put together Live Aid with Harvey Goldsmith.
Wow.
And he used to look after the Eurythmics and Simply Red and AC/DC. And he started the Monsters Rock Festival at Donington. And I grew up with his daughters. We all grew up together. And so he was a big noise at Donington Park, and he kind of helped me and told me about Martin Turner's name. And, you know, he said, just ring up. He was the one that gave me the little nudge to do it. So God rest his soul. It was kind of down to Maurice, really.
What an amazing start to your journey in sport, and particularly obviously in what became MotoGP. Was there anything else, though, that you could have done? Obviously, the huge musical influences that were coming there. Mm. Was there an opportunity there where you may have just gone down a more musical route straight off the bat? Because I know you did, was it business and finance you studied as well? So could that have been a different route for you?
I specialised in marketing with a view to be a music promoter. That's really what I wanted to do.
Okay.
And as I was sort of coming to the end of the degree studies, I got offered the chance to go and work in Japan as a model and actress, really, doing TV commercials and videos and bits and pieces. And it was it's strange because it was one of those opportunities that you couldn't really turn down. It was back in the early 90s. They said, if you don't go now, and I was 21, I think, at the time, you'll be too old to go. So you need to take this contract or not do it, because I'd started doing some part-time modelling to pay my way through Polytechnic, it was then. So I went to Japan and I ended up staying there for pretty much a year, working over there, which was another story entirely extraordinary, to go to Japan in the early 90s where nobody really spoke English. There were no English signs, and it was pretty much like landing on another planet, trying to work everything out. So that kind of also changed my path, because when I came back, I carried on doing that, and I carried on doing TV commercials and bits and pieces in London. So I sort of hadn't gone down the music route there either. And then all this came about with television. So I'd fallen off the music promotion path, I suppose, really, when I went to Japan.
How do you cope? Well, I'm curious to know how you cope with being in the public eye, because I remember when going through some of my memories of watching motorsport, you were very much on the screen when I was sort of, I guess, you know, really getting into the industry. You had a recognisable face because of other work that you'd done, whether it was Gadget Show or whatever. Did you cope okay being a recognised face? Did you feel that when you were sort of pottering around town?
I think when you're working in motorsport, you're away a lot, you know, globally. You're travelling all over the place. And it isn't really until you do a home race, let's say Silverstone or Donington, that you kind of realise that people really know who you are, in a sense. Because going back, I started 25 years ago, and we didn't have social media then, so, you know, you didn't have an open conduit, I suppose, to you personally. You only had paparazzi.
Yeah.
So of course I did go through the paparazzi era. I think I never went to the openings of envelopes, and I tried very much not to talk about my private life in public, and I didn't use anything that happened to me to get column inches. So I didn't really jump in with 2 feet into the press. It terrified me, and it still terrifies me to this day. I used to get a phone call every year from the News of the World back then. Clockwork, every year. We have evidence that you and Gary Lineker have been having an affair.
No.
And we're going to print it. Can you give us a quote? And I said, yeah, print it. Print it. Because I knew it wasn't true, and it happened every single year, and they would just be trying to put two and two together. And those kind of phone calls, you know, they used to put the fear of God at me, because I actually don't like controversy. I'm not very controversial, even though I'm quite feisty on screen. I recognise that. I'm not very much like that at all in my private life. So dealing with being in the public eye, I feel like I've skirted around the edge of it, I suppose, is a good way of describing how I feel about it. There have been times where I've been going out with somebody that's maybe been in the public eye, or, you know, I've been going through a divorce or something, and I've had the paparazzi sitting outside my house, you know, waiting to take pictures. And I just found it incredibly intrusive. So I would do anything to not have that happen, really. Yeah. So I've tried to be quite quiet. But the trouble is, if you're quite quiet, or not really so much now, but back in the day, back, you know, if we go back 20 years, they would just make something up. But
it's terrible, isn't it?
You know, so you couldn't really win. But I think now I find it really quite lovely when people just say hello to you in the street and smile. And I'm quite lucky on social media. I don't really get a lot of nonsense. You know, some of my friends work in football, and I read the stuff that's on their lines, and I can't, you know, I don't think I would be on social media if I was them, because the 99 good things, I will remember the one bad thing.
Yeah, especially on Twitter. I mean, we've talked about it on the show before. It's just such a toxic place on occasion. You know, people hide behind their keyboards.
We've had a lot of, I think, guests, particularly from the W series as well. And you just see the amount of hate they get for no good reason at all. And it's, you know, and it's just so, it's a blessing and a curse, because, you know, you get these big followings, but then also all the baggage that comes with it as well. So it's such a nightmare to navigate, I suppose. And I suppose the other thing, actually, when you're the broadcaster and when you're working as a journalist in sport, you know, the last thing you want to be is the story. You're not the story. The people who are the story is the athletes, isn't it? They're the ones who are in the limelight. They're the people that have come, they're bringing the audiences. So out of all the sport you've done, you know, across motorsport and others, are there any sort of amazing, and you've met some amazing people as well along the way, are there any standout moments, you know, interviews, chats with people that have just stuck with you from the get-go?
I think having the privilege of interviewing these global superstars, really, for want of a better phrase, is incredible. And when someone has either just won a race or just won a championship, I mean, the interviews with Lewis when he'd just won the world championship, and, you know, this champagne's fresh and you can smell it, and the atmosphere, you can cut it, and everybody's excited. Actually, the hairs on my arms are standing up as I'm even saying this to you. I remember the one in Texas was particularly memorable. He was so happy, and he got his arm on my arm, and I'd got my arm on his elbow as well. And it was this, I didn't realize I was doing it till I saw the pictures back afterwards in the interview, but it was almost, I don't know if I'm sort of a little bit mumsy with them, because I'm so much older. I'm like, oh, well, then, you know. But the pictures are really lovely, and you can see the joy in his face. Obviously, he's just become a world champion again. And I'm just so, well, proud of him, in awe of him as well, you know, because he's just so talented, and he's just so brilliant. So I think those kind of interviews stay with me. There was one with Valentino Rossi at Phillip Island. He just won the championship, and he took off his helmet and he got snot all across his face, you know, because this happens sometimes in motorsport. And we were about to go live, and I just put my hand over on his face and I wiped it off his face.
Gross.
And then just did the interview. And I don't profess, after 25 years of knowing Valentino and working with Valentino, that I'm any sort of best friend of Valentino. I'm not, but I know him well enough to do something like that.
I could just imagine you sort of licking the napkin. There you go, Valentino. Let's just get that off and let's crack up.
Oh, it wasn't that bad. It wasn't that bad.
But you mentioned
it. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny, because when I started, I was the young one. The young one in the paddock, you know. I was sort of 27 years old, running around interviewing Mick Doohan and Alex Crevier, and, you know, whoever else was around there, really. And then suddenly you kind of become a different sort of figure in the paddock, and now I do feel a bit like I'm the mum, not maybe like the aunt figure, I don't know, but I these kids are 16 years old now that are racing in Moto3, you know, and I do sort of really get quite anxious about them. And it's an interesting path that's gone on. Sorry, I've kind of digressed from the interviews, but those interviews, when I was covering the Olympics, I also should mention the sailing that year in 2004 was spectacular. They were making all the headlines. They wouldn't say this now, the three blondes in the boat, but the England girls were brilliant that year. Those interviews were really exciting to do, having followed, you know, the journey with them. So I think those are sorts of interviews. I remember interviewing Michael Schumacher as well at a bike event. He came to do a lap. I think he rode on the Ducati, and the whole paddock kind of were waiting for him to come in, and we were told there was no interviews, there was to be no interviews. Well, of course I wasn't going to have that. So I found his manager and I said, oh, you know, blah, 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 BBC. God, loved flying that tag around back in the day. And I said, look, can I just ask two questions? And he said, well, you can ask the questions that, you know, everybody else will have to take the answers from those two questions. So I was like, okay, fine. But it was such a bun fight when he came in to get to the front. You know, it was a big elbows. That was properly one of those charges. And, I duly got my questions in, which pissed off quite a few of the other journalists, I think. But, you know, none of them would ask the manager. So I thought, well, fair enough. But I got it and we went out live on the beach. So they were very happy about it too. So that was another fun one. And always, always a joy to speak to Michael.
A quick interruption to the show to remind you to check out our sponsor, F1 Experiences. F1 Experiences offer a wide range of packages that come direct from Formula One, giving you a unique experience of the pinnacle of motorsport. Official ticket packages come with the very best race tickets, first-class hotels and transfers, and unprecedented access, including track tours, pit lane walks, VIP hospitality, and loads more. It really is the closest you can get to Formula One. And thanks to F1 Experiences, you can return to the track this year, and Motormouth listeners can save 5% on your next F1 Experience package by using the code Motormouth when booking online at f1experiences.com.
And you mentioned
flying the BBC flag right there.
Exactly. Back in those days,
you mentioned about being quite sort of feisty on camera and, you know, getting your elbows out, things like that. Is that a difficult thing to do? I think that's what I would really struggle with when you're in like a media pit and you've got, you know, drivers coming at you and journalists from all over the world fighting for space and questions. Do you feel all right in that scenario, just sort of, you know, nudging a few people out of the way and making sure you get in there first?
I don't think it's really like that anymore, to be honest, because it's so well organised. So in Formula One, you know, you see the structure with the pen and they come round and they do interviews pretty much with all the journalists. So it's much more controlled than when I first started, when it is just smash, bang, wallop.
Yeah.
And, I guess up until about sort of 10, 12 years ago, it was a bit crazy, but yeah, it wasn't my favourite part. But I would go into robot mode and know that I had to get those answers for our show. And predominantly my feeling on a race weekend is always about how to get the best content for the show and what I would want if I was sitting at home, what I would want to know. So if I feel like we haven't quite done something properly, it irks me until the next race.
Yeah.
So yeah, I can put myself in that position, but you know, you don't have to do that now. It's all quite sedate. And
well, especially these days, no one's in the paddocks anymore with all the
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
all the various rules, but it has been nice to see, you know, teams slowly start to come back into the paddock. You brought up a few F1 memories there, and obviously you started on two wheels, and then in 2013 you moved over to F1 and the four wheel world as the first permanent female anchor. How did you adapt to that switch to four wheels? Were you always a bit an F1 fan as well? Was that something you had to get to grips with quite quickly?
Yeah, in 98, I did a motorsport show, a little sort of magazine show, which covered lots of different series and car series. So I was kind of doing two wheels and four wheels in the early days. But yeah, I mean, I know I'm much more well known for two wheels. To be honest, I'm not sure how well I did in the first year. I found it very difficult. There was a lot of... what's the way to describe this? It's quite challenging, let's say. And I, looking back, probably could have done with a bit more support in different ways. But there was a lot of the things there that I did really enjoy. And I think by the end of the first season, I felt like I'd cracked it. And I really enjoyed the second and third year and was actually looking forward to the rest of the contract, which, you know, we'd all got under our belts, which we thought we were going to do with the BBC. So I thought I had three more years. But yeah, you're talking about slipping in with the sort of between. There'd been a few years I hadn't done MotoGP, actually. I'd stopped doing MotoGP. I was doing the Gadget Show. I was trying to have a family at the time. So there's quite a lot going on personally as well as professionally. And then in 2012, I got asked to go and do Formula One. So that was obviously, you know, amazing to be asked to do it. Terrifying as well, stepping into, you know, good shoes. Jake Humphrey done an incredible job. There'd been a lot of noise around Jake coming in, and the kind of relationship that had organically grown between EJ and DC and Jake was good. You know, it was strong. It was comparable to the Top Gear boys. And to come in, I knew I was going to get some shit, for want of a better word, really, from various different people. Didn't realise I was going to get quite so much from women, but there you go. That just shows how girls can be sometimes. So, yeah, it took a little while to settle in. It took me a season to settle in. But interestingly, I had a conversation with Martin Brundle, and because the Sky guys were actually very supportive and very kind, and I spent quite a lot of time with them. And Martin said it always takes a season wherever you've come from to feel comfortable here. And I did have some lovely friends in the paddock. Nikki Lauda, you know, was very good support for me. Toto was always very kind. DC was brilliant. Eddie became brilliant. So, you know, we did get there. But yeah, I found it tough the first year. And I just found the way that we covered it was a bit different to what I'd been used to. But I think I probably had to up my game. And I look back and think it probably made me a better broadcaster.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, fair play to you. I think it's very hard going into that environment, and you know, you'd done so much in MotoGP, and were so well respected there, and like you say, having to fill Jake's shoes. But I think you did a fantastic job, and you know, credit to you. Now, listen, you've done your F1 coverage, you've done your MotoGP coverage, you've had some highlights, but nothing will come close to this. Susie Perry, it is time to introduce you to the Motormouth quiz. I'll pass you over to my illustrious bearded colleague to tell you more.
Yes, Susie Perry, welcome to the hardest quiz in motorsport, Motormouths, quite frankly, because sometimes I'm not even sure if the answers are correct. So I've got four questions for you and a bonus question, all to do with you and your career and the ins and outs of it. It should hopefully, I've done the questions, I think you should be okay. There are 14 points up for grabs. At the moment, Nelson Piquet Jr. and Lee McKenzie are tied at the top on 14 points, along with, and then we've got some other people who's down. Natalie Pinkham's got 12 points, then Mark Blundell is down there with 12, so it's a big long leaderboard.
Blundell won't be happy with that, will he?
He was fuming.
I think that you've just mentioned a few tryhards there. I'm not quite sure about this.
let's see if you can get into double digits, fingers crossed. Are you ready for your first question?
I think so.
There we go then. All right. So during your first season covering F1, as we just discussed, for the BBC in 2013, how many British drivers were on the grid And can you name them all?
Right. How many British drivers? So there was there would have been Max.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Obviously Lewis.
Yeah.
Gents.
Yeah.
Saving
the big gun till last.
He's
Lewis.
Look, you've got Lewis, Jensen, and Max Chilton. There is one more.
Who Harry idolises.
He's my number one.
To an unhealthy degree.
It's a strange driver to be a particular fan of.
It's also a very one-way relationship, isn't it?
This was his last season in Formula One. Well, yeah, it was his last season in Formula One. He's from David Coulthard land.
Shh. Giving it away.
It was Paul.
Yeah.
Paul Duresta, yeah, Paul.
Full House.
Paul.
Good old Paul Duresta.
Remiss of me.
PDR.
I'll give you a half point for that. You can claw back some points if you can tell me what teams they raced for.
Hang on, you've just taken a half point away from me.
She got them right.
Yeah, but we had to give you Paul Duresta.
Oh, no, I think she should have all of those.
can you tell me, I'll reinstate it if you can tell me the teams that they raced for.
Lewis, hadn't gone, has he gone, oh God, had he gone to Mercedes? I think he had.
Yes, he had.
Oh. Yes, he had.
And I think it was his first year. Was it his first year? Yeah, I think it was.
His first year.
I feel like I've got early dementia coming on.
Oh, no. The others should be fairly... Well, Jensen, who was he with? Because obviously him and Hamilton were teammates previously, weren't they?
Well, so Jensen was still with McLaren.
Yep.
Yes, correct. And then the last two could be easy, could be difficult. Not sure.
Max was with Marussia.
Yep.
Yes. Spot on. And good old Paul Duresta.
It was Paul. Bloody hell. This is bad.
You know, you've clawed back some points already, so this is just for additional pride now.
I think we're back up to full house on this.
I'm giving you the full points anyway, because you've done well there. But if you can get the final... Can we do it? It was a midfield team, representing a whole country in a way.
Bit of a dodgy team owner.
Oh gosh, Force India, yeah.
There you go.
There we go. We got there.
Yeah,
okay,
that's
right.
Dodgy, isn't it?
That was just question one, Susie. Okay.
Oh my God.
the next one should be easy and a bit quicker. Let's head over to two wheels. The current championship leader in MotoGP is the Frenchman, Fabio Quartararo, but... Can you tell me how old he is and where in France he was born?
That's a tough one, where in France he was born.
It was, yeah, but it's a mainstream place, so hopefully...
He's 22.
Correct. He is 22 years old, correct.
I feel like it's Nice.
Correct.
It is Nice.
In one.
Fabulous.
The 22-year-old from Nice, Fabio Quartararo. There we go, we're back on track. Okay, question three. How much older... is Valentino Rossi than Lewis Hamilton?
Oh, God.
To the nearest 1 year-ish.
Now, Valentino's 42.
Mm-hmm.
That is correct, yeah.
And Lewis is, I can't remember. What's Lewis now? Lewis has got to be... like 35? Something like that?
So
am I in the ballpark?
You're absolutely in the ballpark, yes.
Or is he 34?
Oh.
You're getting colder.
35. Is he 36?
He might be.
So say he was maybe 35, 36. What's the gauge gap there? What are you going for? If you're within one, I'll give it to you.
I'll go with 35 because that's what I said first. So let's say 7 years.
Oh, it's actually six. He's 36, so the gap is 6 years. But I'll give you the point anyway because you're in the ballpark.
This is looking really good. At the moment, you're on track to get a podium position.
You are right up there, Susie. We've got one more question and then a bonus point for you to get as well. So question four. You began presenting the what was MotoGP or what became MotoGP in 1997 as the reporter, as we discussed. Who was the champion that year?
Who became champion in 1997? Who was champion in 1997?
Who became champion in 1997 at the end of the season?
I think it was 1997 would have still been Mick Doohan.
Oh, absolutely spot on.
This is getting tense now.
This is if you get this, you are going right to the top. We've actually salvaged this. Your bonus point here. Now, I'm not entirely sure about this answer. It's the best I could do on the old Google. How many series of the Gadget Show have there been in total? I think if you get in around the ballpark, we'll give you the point here.
I think within five, because there's been a lot.
Yeah.
I did 16 series in the first 8 years.
It's still going?
Yes, currently it's still going. So there was 2012.
Oh, she's doing the numbers on it. She's doing the finger maths.
10 fingers.
She's got the digits.
So there could have been another 20 series since then, I think. Let's say if I did 16... 36,
let's say
35.
Oh my word.
That is the number I have written down. Yeah. 35 series. That is incredible. Susie Perry, that's one extra bonus point. And you know what that does? I don't even need to do the maths. That sends you
to
the top of the leaderboard. Susie Perry, you are on top, the head of the rest. PK Jr., Lee McKenzie, who are Connor Daly from Mark Webber, ahead of him as well, right at the top.
Oh, I'll take being ahead of Mark Webber.
Yeah, you are. He could only do 12. So you've
I'm going to message
14.
Him now.
Insert applause.
Unbelievable. Susie Perry, thank you very much for playing the hardest quiz in motorsport.
Goodness me, well done. Plimineck. I have to say, when we first started that quiz, if we had fast forwarded a few minutes, I wasn't expecting you, let's be honest, to be top of the leaderboard, but you are. That first one was a challenge.
It was a slow start. You know why? Honestly, I'll tell you a secret. My memory is absolutely shit. And I can't remember, like, as you could tell there, really big things. I can't remember stuff. So to go back to 2013 for me is very difficult.
You did very well. You did very well indeed. Now, that's the highlight of your career out the way, which you can feel free to reference in future interviews.
Well,
I think it is the greatest point of your career. Starstruck. Let's talk about that. Have you ever got starstruck? I mean, you've mentioned some of the big names that you've interviewed. Have you ever stood in front of someone and thought, holy shit, I am nervous?
Probably not so much within sport, but Eric Clapton once came to Silverstone and I love him so much. I've seen him so many times live. And I stood next to him and I couldn't speak to him. And I was so annoyed with myself afterwards. With Eric Clapton, I suppose. And it is a motorsport memory because it was at Silverstone. He'd come to the Formula One. I just felt like such an idiot.
When you're with someone that if you're not interviewing someone, but you're with someone that you admire or even someone famous, it's different to this kind of scenario, like where we're here to interview you. But if you're stood next to someone like that, it is different. And the only way I can compare it, and I'm not comparing Eamon Holmes here to Eric Clapton, but I was at a services the other day and Eamon came pottering in through the doors and he went, oh, thanks for holding the door, wherever it was. And in my head, I was going, come on, ask for a photo. And I didn't do it and I've been kicking myself ever since.
No, it's a shame because Eamon's fantastic. And Eamon is one of the, obviously, a very, very familiar face to us all. Who you can strike up a conversation with about holding the door open or about anything at all. He's just genuinely a really lovely, lovely human being. But I suppose, you know, faced with Eric Clapton or whoever your idol might be, it's hard to strike up a conversation without hearing yourself back and what you're saying, thinking, you idiot, you idiot. And I see it a lot, you know, when someone sort of comes up to you and says something and it's the same thing that you've heard a million times before, you know, what's Valentino Rossi like or whatever. I don't want to be that person that says to Eric Clapton, oh, I love your music, or I went to see you at so-and-so, because I just think he probably doesn't give a shit about that. So it's better if you can strike up a conversation with somebody about the fact that you've held the door open and, you know, I don't know, you're like, oh, yeah, it's my new job, whatever. But you can do that. And I think it's easier if you're in a scenario where you're not interviewing somebody and something does happen that's a bit normal every day, yeah, that you can start talking, because then you can get into a normal conversation. But to open a conversation with somebody, I think, is very, very difficult if you, you know, if you do love them.
And I love Eamon. I do love Eamon.
Yeah, I love Eamon as well.
Who doesn't love Eamon Holmes? It's a hard man not to love. Yeah. You'll rue that one, Tim. You'll rue it.
Yeah.
Now, Susie, arguably you've done a bit less in the last year travel-wise, but it's been a huge part of your career, especially when you work in motorsport and sport in general. How have you coped with it? I suppose it must be quite draining, you know, not just physically, but mentally as well.
It's the worst bit. You know, I tell you what's really interesting this year. I did my final interview with Valentino Rossi at Silverstone and the BRDC club. And bearing in mind that he's been racing at top level for 26, 27 years. And he said to me that the switch went off 2 years ago and he realised that getting on a plane and going to the same racetracks all over the world, staying in the same place, going to the track, coming back again, was actually quite tedious. It had taken him 25 years to get to that point. Mm. Now, I think anybody that's in production or broadcasting will say it's the travel that does you. It does you in the end, because you spend usually the whole life, your whole year being jet lagged, pretty much 9 months being jet lagged or tired. And you shouldn't say it out loud, because it's a privileged position to be in, of course, to be doing this job. It's the best job in the world. But yeah, the travel is rubbish. If you could click your fingers and just appear in Australia or China or America or whatever, then yeah, you know, I would definitely want to do that. For me, it's the down part, and it's the part that ultimately will probably make me go, I'm done with this now.
Yeah, no, I can fully get on board with that. I've done my fair share of travelling, and actually I've just started travelling again after all the lockdown shenanigans. And my most recent experience, just to highlight how challenging it now is, was at the Berlin finale for Formula E. And I went out there to work with a company called Vestas, who sponsor Mercedes EQ, and got to my hotel, checked in, fist pumped Mark Webber randomly at reception, then went to get my PCR test, which was positive. So I spent the next 8 or 9 days in a hotel room in Berlin, missed all of the race, missed all of the work I was supposed to do, and then eventually managed to go home. But it was an absolute disaster. And fortunately, I've got relatively sound mind, but I can imagine if I was in any way, shape or form unstable in any way, my mental health would have been absolutely broken after literally spending 8 days in a Berlin hotel room.
So what's the moral of that story? Do you know?
I think the moral is probably just don't travel. Don't go anywhere.
The moral of the story is not to fist bump Mark Webber.
Well, I thought, I feel okay saying that now, because it was a while ago now, but at the time I was like, oh God, I've given Mark Webber COVID. So I was thinking if it comes out that he's got COVID, then it's clearly my fault. Fortunately, he didn't, so I didn't pass it on. But I shouldn't fist pump full stop, because the amount of times I've done that thing where, you know, you've got a fist pump and someone grabs your hand or like grabs a finger, or you just sort of flop into each other's hands. It's just a shame.
I'll tell you, this is a brief sidetrack, but the worst time I've ever done that, I think I told this story to you, Tim, as well. When I was starting out as a runner, and one of my first jobs was with Five Live, the BBC, being a runner, helping Jenny Gow out at Silverstone.
Oh, I love Jenny.
On the grid, and she was about to interview Anthony Joshua, and I was stood there just with him, helping him wait for Jenny to come over, and he looks at me, he's like, oh, you're right, mate, and he goes in with the fist bump and I go in with the handshake, when it's Anthony Joshua. Yeah, luckily, it was a last minute swerve and we just about avoided it, but we all knew what would have happened. So that was the worst time, I think. That's when it's up against a boxer like that. I don't think there's any coming back from it, is it?
You were going to say a boxing legend like that, but he's no longer a legend because he's been defeated twice.
He has been defeated. But we digress, Susie.
Yeah.
Because we're running out of time with you. But we do a final three questions that we ask.
No points
up for grabs.
Not a test.
No, nothing to gain, I'm afraid. But there are final three brought to you by F1 Experiences. Tim, do you want to kickstart?
I do. Susie, what's got you excited at this very moment?
I'm going out for lunch with my parents.
Ooh, that's very exciting for me. Where are you going? Nice restaurant?
I'm going to a restaurant called Fiume, which is an Italian restaurant where lots of Wolves players go. So secretly, while I'm having a lovely time with my mum and dad, I'll be just looking over their shoulder to see who's coming in.
See what you've done there. Clever.
See who's about. Get a photo or two. See who's, yeah. See who's holding the door open.
Yeah. See Pedro Neto comes in.
Well, enjoy your lunch. Second question for you. What's your favourite MotoGP destination?
My favourite destination is Austin, but it's not my favourite racetrack. My favourite racetrack is Mugello.
Yeah. Okay.
Ooh. Austin.
How, is it more fun in Austin and actual racing's good in Mugello?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, Mugello's beautiful. It's in the middle of Tuscany. Of course, it's absolutely gorgeous and everything about it is wonderful. And it's Valentino land and I love it. And I've got so many happy memories there. Austin is fun for the night out, for the bands, for the live music, for the crazy, for the dueling piano bar, you know, and everybody's out there. And I feel like when you go on a long haul race in motorsport, the riders and the drivers forget that they're famous and they throw themselves in. So you just have these wildfires, which are brilliant.
Yep, absolutely. Couldn't agree more. Final question for you before we let you get on with your day. What are you scared of?
I'm scared of... I don't know. What am I scared of? I'm not sure, really. That's the worst answer you've ever had.
Well, how are you with, you know, little creepy crawlies, spiders? Would you ever go into the jungle, actually? That's a good question.
I'm fine with that sort of stuff. I love it. I'm massively into nature and animals, and I save everything. So it's not a spider. I'm not as good with heights as I once was. So probably the crazy things I used to do in the gadget show, I don't think I would jump off bridges now and out of planes. So maybe that should be what I'm scared of.
Mm. I think fair enough.
You would have you ever considered the jungle or any of those shows?
It's always a timing thing, to be honest, for me, because they cross over the end of the season. So I have been asked to go in the jungle, and I did consider it, but it meant missing so many races. I couldn't do that because, you know, for contractual reasons. I'd love to do Strictly. I'd love to learn to dance properly. That would be amazing. Well, those are the two, really, that I think I'd probably entertain. Or maybe MasterChef. Maybe I should be MasterChef. Yeah. And I like cooking. So.
What's your favourite dish to cook?
I don't eat meat, so it'll be all vegetable things. I love curries, so let's go with the curry option.
Solid,
that's a good choice.
You love
I like that you don't eat meat.
I'm from Wolverhampton.
I'm in the middle of my plant-based clean diet, and so I can vouch for the whole not eating meat thing. I'm doing eating a tiny bit, but most of it is completely clean and unprocessed, and I genuinely have never felt better in my life. Like right now, as of this morning on the 5th of October, 11:23, I have never felt better. I feel lighter than I have done for a year and a half, and I wake up in the morning, like, I leap out of bed. I'm like, I'm ready for the day, and usually I'm a hungover mess. So I'm enjoying this this newfound.
You were an amazing advert there for plant based food.
Yeah,
I'm
all over
4 years, I think now, and very happy to be maintaining that. And it, you know what it actually does? It just changes the way that you think about eating and cooking. And I find the food much more tasty, and I'm glad that restaurants are getting into it as well now. And I mean, apart from the obvious thing that you shouldn't eat meat, but people seem to eat meat every single day these days, whereas I think when I was growing up that didn't happen. My granddad was a butcher, so I'm not sure he'd be particularly impressed with me right now, but anyway, you definitely should have days where you don't put meat in your body, ideally 7.
There's another podcast
we'll use that as the clip for when we
Hate. Everybody will hate on me.
People won't be expecting that from this kind of podcast. We do talk about everything on here. We really could talk to you all day, I think, Susie. But we have run out of time there, I think. But thank you so much for coming onto the show. It's been great to get you on and chat to you about your life and your career and all the things you're up to. It's been great to get your insights as well. So Susie Perry, thank you very much for joining us on the Motormouth podcast.
Thank you very much. Absolute pleasure to talk to you both. Really, really enjoyed it. And I'm now going to hunt for wolf players.
Before you go, one final reminder to check out F1 Experiences, the official experience, hospitality and travel program of Formula One. F1 Experiences is the closest you can get to the sport. Official ticket packages, which include the best race tickets, first class hotels, travel and exclusive behind the scenes access across a Grand Prix weekend. F1 Experiences offer packages like no other. So to book your F1 Experiences package, head online to f1experiences.com. And if you enter code Motormouth, you'll get 5% off too. Thank you so much for listening to the Motormouth podcast. Do make sure you give us a follow on our socials, Twitter at Motormouth _, Instagram at Motormouth _official, and Facebook, just search Motormouth. You can also download the Motormouth app where you can get exclusive video content from MMTV, create your own social profile to interact with other fans and check up on all the latest happenings with whatever motorsport takes your fancy. We're also proud to be supporting the Brain Tumor Charity too, so make sure you check the links in the podcast description to find out how you can help cure brain tumors quicker. Don't forget to like, subscribe and review, and until next time, you've been listening to the Motormouth podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.